from Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from the Independent Media Center in Los Angeles. Breaking with convention, power, protest, and the presidency. Joseph Lieberman addresses the Democratic Convention, and as police attack demonstrators once again, we'll have a debate on strategies of resistance. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. First, news headlines.
Embarking on what he called a miraculous journey, Vice Presidential candidate Joseph Lieberman urged Americans Wednesday night to elect Al Gore to the White House, hailing him before the Democratic National Convention as a man of vision and values who would extend the nation's current prosperity.
Meanwhile, outside of the Staples Center where the Democratic National Convention is taking place, thousands of people rallied against police brutality. As protesters were moving into the protest pen, police baton charged them, knocking many protesters and journalists over. The violence against the protesters has continued.
Another death row inmate was executed in Texas last night. John Satterwhite, 53, was the third inmate scheduled to die this month in Texas and the 29th this year in the nation's busiest death house. Satterwhite fatally shot Mary Frances Davis, a convenience store clerk, on March 12, 1979 in San Antonio. He declined to make a final statement before he was given the lethal injection and was pronounced dead at 6:29 in the evening. He was permitted to call the Associated Press less than an hour before his death. Prison officials generally allowed an inmate a few final calls to relatives, but a call to the media from a prisoner is unprecedented.
This news from San Francisco. A federal jury has cleared seven guards at Pelican Bay State Prison of allegations that they used excessive force on a convicted murderer. The guards contended they took appropriate measures to subdue the prisoner who was resisting them. Lawyers for the guards, who were sued by Thomas Brissett, said the prisoner had refused to move when he was ordered in 1991 to share a cell with another prisoner. Brissett's lawyer, Michael Gewertz, argued that his client had asked not to share a cell with the prisoner, a known gang member. Gewertz said guards broke up a fight that erupted almost immediately between the two men by shooting Brissett with rubber pellets, shocking him with a stun gun, clubbing him, then tying him up and dropping him 3 feet onto a litter on a concrete floor.
The Justice Department has awarded more than $7 million in grants to seven states to begin clearing a large backlog of DNA genetic samples obtained from convicted criminals but never analyzed. The grants from the department's National Institute of Justice will allow these states to analyze 145,000 backlog samples out of a nationwide backlog that a national commission recently estimated at 750,000. California, Florida, Minnesota, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Washington will share the first $7 million.
And Republican vice presidential nominee Richard Cheney officially left his oil services firm yesterday, the largest in the world, with a generous retirement package. Cheney received shares and stock options from Halliburton Company, worth more than $13.6 million, this according to officials of the Dallas-based company and filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. He had received a salary of $1.3 million and earned $3 million by selling Halliburton stock in May.
And this news from Port-au-Prince, President René Préval declared the results of Haiti's parliamentary elections official yesterday, despite criticism from some foreign governments who have questioned the results. The totals printed in the official government publication Le Moniteur confirmed an overwhelming victory by the Lavalas family party of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The party won 18 of 19 seats in the upper house and 72 of 82 in the lower house in May, June, and July balloting. The Lavalas family has also won about 80% of Haiti's 133 city halls. The European Union, the United States, and Canada have questioned the formula used to calculate winners of the races and have threatened to withhold aid if the results are not revised.
In this news from Moscow, the Russian Orthodox Church's highest body closed a meeting highlighted by the decision to canonize Tsar Nicholas II. The Bishop's Council also adopted a social doctrine that denounces the use of force in international affairs and that calls for the end of the death penalty. The Church opposes the death penalty not only because it can make a judicial error irreparable, but also because the penalty causes controversy in society. This according to the Etertas news agency. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a first-ever broadcast combining community radio and community television as we air on community radio stations and public access cable stations around the country. Last night, Al Gore's vice presidential candidate Joseph Lieberman took center stage at the Democratic Convention. Throughout his speech, he attempted to portray himself as a civil rights activist, saying he walked with Martin Luther King in the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. Later, he said he'd worked in the South registering African Americans to vote. He made multiple references to his family's religion. He is Orthodox Jewish, as well as his family's having fled communism. Lieberman has come under fire from Latinos and African Americans in particular since he was announced as Gore's vice presidential candidate for his positions on a number of issues: pro-school vouchers, supporting California's anti-immigrant Prop 187. Last night, he addressed the issue of affirmative action, which he's been accused of opposing. He said, quote, "When it comes to affirmative action, mend it. Please don't end it." We now turn to Houston Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee for comment. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Jackson Lee.
Yes.
Congressmember Jackson Lee, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. How are you?
Very good to have you with us. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Can you respond to Joseph Lieberman's speech that he gave at the convention?
I think it was deep from his heart, a compassionate speech, a real speech, a reflection of the mosaicness of this nation. Joe Lieberman tonight showed us the compassion that is real, not a shadow, illusion, not perception and not misconception. I think Joe Lieberman touched people from all walks of life, whether your sexual orientation is different, whether your race is different, whether your religion is different. He showed America that it is a real possibility that those of you or those of us who come to this nation in different ways or are in different styles and philosophies can be accepted.
And so you feel that he puts to rest any questions that some members of the Black Caucus in Congress or other African-American Latino leaders have had about his positions that some would deem an anathema to the Democratic Party?
Well, I think what we have to look at is Joe Lieberman's record. First of all, tonight he committed himself to the policies of mend it, don't end it. And that's what many of us in the Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, women have said all along. We've all said that quotas are illegal, but that affirmative action outreach and the emphasis on diversity is key and important. Joe Lieberman tonight said that he believes and understands the importance of involvement of all groups. You know, Joe Lieberman comes from a history where years ago in the 1930s and earlier, and maybe even later, that there were quotas that kept people out, certainly kept African Americans out, certainly kept those from the Jewish community out, and certainly kept any number of people out. And so quotas, we know, are detrimental and destructive. Tonight he took a stand for affirmatively working to ensure that our country is diverse. Out of that comes diverse position, diverse empowerment economically, diversity in education, diversity in leadership. So yes, I think Joe Lieberman answered not our questions, but answered America's question about who he is.
Is it true, Congressmember Jackson Lee, that over the last few days there's been controversy within the Congressional Black Caucus, led by Maxine Waters, Congressmember of Los Angeles, questioning whether even to endorse the ticket with Joe Lieberman as the number two man.
I don't think so. I don't think the Congressional Black Caucus entertained the thought of not endorsing him because many of us already knew him. I think it was important to have a clarification of his position. Let's clear the air. Let's not have the rumor and innuendo that he was against affirmative action. In fact, his votes to eliminate the opposition to affirmative action were very positive, meaning that he voted against amendments by my own Senator Phil Graham to eliminate affirmative action. It was good tonight that he reported that. It was good tonight that he clarified his position. So I think the questions being raised by individual CBC members were reasonable questions. Let's get it out on the record, Joe Lieberman. Who are you? What do you believe in and what do you stand for? And tonight he made it very, very clear. And I think Black America, Hispanic America, women in America, and people of good faith who believe in affirmative action, but it is, will know that Joe Lieberman is with them as well.
Well, we're joined also here in the studio by Earl Afari Hutchinson, who's an author and longtime commentator at KPFK in Los Angeles, and has written an op-ed piece for the LA Times looking at the same question. Earl?
Well, you know, one thing, I did hear the Joe Lieberman speech last night, and the thing I'm concerned about, even though he did say mend it, don't end it, even though he was very clear about public financing on education, didn't say anything about school vouchers, which, of course, was another concern. You know, I still hear a lot away from the elector arena. I still hear a lot of individuals on the street wonder about Joe Lieberman. They really don't know him as an individual, and you're right. There's a lot of rumors. There's a lot of innuendo. But yet and still, people tend to believe those kinds of things. And so I'm just wondering, at this point in time, even though we have 2 months left in the during the election campaign, what impact do you think on the street, not just with elected officials, but on the street in the community voters, do you think that at least some of the adverse reaction so far and the adverse comments about Joe Lieberman's record may have in terms of turning some African Americans and Latinos off and maybe even making them stay home?
Well, we're going to take a listen to what Joseph Lieberman had to say last night on the convention floor. And we want to thank Sheila Jackson Lee, the congressmember from Houston, Texas, for joining us. This is Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, now the Democrats' vice presidential nominee.
And I've also tried to see America through the eyes of people I've been privileged to know. In the early 1960s, when I was a college student, I walked with Martin Luther King in the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. That was my honor. That was my opportunity. And later that fall, I went to Mississippi, where we worked to register African Americans to vote. The people I met never forgot that in America, every time a barrier is broken, the doors of open opportunity go wider for every single one of us. And I know that in a very personal way tonight. And I've tried to see America through the eyes of families who had the deck stacked against them but fought back. As Connecticut's Attorney General, I work to be the people's lawyer. I went after polluters who were spoiling our water and our air. I stood with single moms to go after deadbeat dads. And you know what? We even sued oil companies who were trying to gouge consumers at the pump. Yes, we did. Go. right to the White House for a better America. Through the eyes of my wife and her parents. By now, most of you probably know Hadassah's story. Her family was literally saved by the greatest generation of American GIs who liberated the concentration camps. We could never express our gratitude enough to them. And then her parents escaped communism and were welcomed as immigrants to America and given a new life here. The fact that half a century later, their daughter would be standing on this stage is a testament to the continuing power of the American dream. And in my life, I have also tried to see this world through the eyes of those who have suffered discrimination. And that's why I believe that the time has come to tear down the remaining walls of discrimination in this nation, walls of discrimination based on race and gender and sexual orientation.
Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman, the Democratic nominee for vice president, speaking last night at the Democratic convention here in Los Angeles, California. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guest is Earl Afari Hutchinson, who is an author and commentator. His latest book, The Disappearance of Black Leadership. Your response to that excerpt of Joe Lieberman's speech.
You know, one thing I'm thinking of is Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Congresswoman Maxine Waters and a couple of other key members in the Congressional Black Caucus put a lot of pressure on Joe Lieberman and Al Gore to make that speech. He had to be very mindful of their criticism because, you know, we talked about public education, we talked about school vouchers, we talked about affirmative action and other issues, which, needless to say, many members of the Congressional Black Caucus, with all due respect to the Congresswoman that spoke a few minutes earlier, but there were substantive disagreements with Joe Lieberman. So, you know, Maxine sent a real clear shot across the party bow when she said, look, you're going to have to say something that's going to show that you, in fact, support our interests. Our interests mean progressive slash liberal slash interests that have to do with civil rights and social issues. And up until this point, you got to remember, Joe Lieberman, was his record at best was very ambiguous on all of these key and critical issues. So when I hear this kind of speech, it is a compromise speech. It is clearly designed to play very calculatingly to blacks, Latinos, Asians, labor, environmentalists, and those out there that have major, major, major questions about Joe Lieberman. So, again, I see that as a compromise speech reaching out once again to the core constituency. And no matter what Al Gore and Joe Lieberman may think privately, the core constituency is still labor. It's still environmentalists. It's still Latinos. It's still African Americans. If you alienate them, you're dead in the water.
Well, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk about Joseph Lieberman, also President or Vice President Gore, who'd like to be president, and what's happening in the streets as well with Earl Afari Hutchinson, who is a longtime observer and activist on the issues of police behavior in Los Angeles. This week doesn't seem to be too much different than the times before. Well, we'll see what he thinks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Ooh, Well, there's two parties that we love so dear. We want a president to last for 4 years. Oh, but we don't care which one you choose, because we own the Democrat Party and Republicrats too. Come on now. Nomination. We choose the choices, now the choice is up to you. We are the corporations. We're gonna celebrate no matter which party you choose. Let's party now. It's time for the ruling class to come together to increase our wealth beyond our measure. Today, D.C., tomorrow, the world. Come on.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez, as we broadcast out of the Independent Media Center in Patriotic Hall, just a few blocks from the Staples Center, where last night Joseph Lieberman took center stage as he gave his main address as the Democratic vice presidential nominee. And I should say, if you can hear a lot of noise in the background, there is a big audience here at Patriotic Hall for Democracy Now! In the studios here of a busy newsroom of independent journalists, and also around the country, from radio listeners to community television and Dish Network listeners as well. And we welcome you all and let you know that also we are broadcasting on the web at democracynow.org, and encourage your emails at democracy@pacifica.org. Juan?
Well, Earl, I'd like to continue with what we were talking about before the break in terms of this question of the energizing of the base of the Democratic Party, because clearly in the discussions I've had with in the last few days with several of the Latino delegates and major leaders from New York and other places, there is not a lot of enthusiasm for Lieberman as a candidate. In terms of labor, he's got one of the highest ratings from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce of any Democrat in the Senate in terms of his voting positions. So I can't see his labor being all that enthusiastic about him either. And that's going to translate into the question, really, not whether the leaders endorse him, but whether the base of the Democratic voters turn out. And, of course, with Republicans always vote. The Democrats, it's a question of whether Democrats go out to the polls or not, and independents are more likely to vote than are Democrats. So what's your sense of what's going to happen at the base?
You know, over and over it's been said, Juan, you're absolutely correct. Even though the leadership, I mean, what do you expect from the Latino, Hispanic caucus, the Black caucus, Congressional Black caucus? Of course they're going to support Gore Lieberman. I mean, really, they are Democrats. I mean, they are rock, rib, solid Democrats. Their job is to deliver the goods for the Democratic Party, and Jesse Jackson, too. But at the same time, we saw something today. Reports that came out about Ralph Nader. There is an extremely high probability, or at least possibility, that five key states may, in fact, swing with a heavy vote toward Ralph Nader. And, of course, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and other states, again, hot contested seats, states between Gore and Bush. If that, in fact, happens, what we're seeing now, Juan, going back full circle, the base, labor, African Americans, Latinos, they're going to be critically important to stay within the Democratic camp. That means that they're going to have, especially with the Black and Latino vote, Blacks, you're talking about 80 to 85% historically over the last 30 years have voted Democratic. Latinos, a little bit less, 75 to 80%. Nonetheless, if there's any break, any dent whatsoever, any departure, any softening in that, Gore is in big trouble. So let's face facts. George Bush is in a comfortable position now. People keep saying diversity and inclusion. They keep taking shots at the Republican Party in convention, calling it a sideshow and a minstrel show and all that. That's not the point. The point is they don't have to win a majority or influence a majority of Blacks or Latinos, just 5 to 10%. And if that 5 to 10% is influenced either to vote Republican or not vote at all, because, again, they're not energized, given the Ralph Nader factor, Gore, I'm telling you, is in deep, deep, deep trouble. Well, frankly, he can't win.
Earl Afari Hutchinson is a commentator and author. In fact, his latest book is called The Disappearance of Black Leadership.
Well, when you were saying about the shift, for instance, when Ronald Reagan, in both of his elections, Ronald Reagan got 30 to 40% of the Latino vote, and it was a question of that shift from 30 to 40% in some states like Florida and others that allowed Clinton to for instance, carry Florida, because he was able to get a lot much larger segment of the Latino vote. So it is a question of you're fighting for a small share of a swing in those votes.
Yeah, and because let's go back to, since we're talking about core constituency, let's look at the other side. Obviously, you're talking about blacks, you're talking about Latinos, you're talking about labor, environmentalists, gays, and so forth. Core constituency in the Democratic Party. On the other side, who is Bush's core constituency? Essentially, you're talking about conservative, well-to-do white guys. Basically, that's the constituency for George Bush. They're going nowhere. I think you mentioned a little bit earlier, Amy. They're going to vote. They're going to vote no matter what. One thing that bothered me about the selection of Lieberman, just from the point of view of a Democratic strategist, I would be troubled by this. Obviously, Lieberman's record is very mixed. He's a centrist conservative Democrat, no question about that, despite his speech tonight, his conciliatory speech and his gestures that he's making. Nonetheless, I think it was an attempt on the part of Al Gore to say, perhaps we can make a dent in the Gore's key constituency, the core constituency of the conservative mid-America, conservative, you know, white males. It's not going to work, because think about it. Why, if I'm in fact in that constituency block, why would I want to vote for a cheap imitation when I can have the real thing, namely G.W. Bush? So you're not going to gain on that end. And on the other end, when you mentioned before about perhaps minimizing or at least dampening the core constituency, especially people of color, it's a risky business that Gore is taking here. And I'm not so sure the strategy is going to pay off, to be honest with you.
Earl Afari Hutchinson, you mentioned Ralph Nader, and it's not just about Gore saying, well, you know, where would African Americans go so I can do whatever I want? Well, they can choose not to go to the polls, and that's a problem. But what about the Nader factor? How much of an African American constituency does Ralph Nader have?
I think very little. But that's not the point. The point is he doesn't have to have any constituency among African Americans because, first of all, he's not addressing quote-unquote civil rights, you know, social program issues in a major, major way. I mean, Ralph Nader is the prime consumer advocate, probably the emblematic personification of the consumer advocate in this country and environmentalists, anti-corporations, big business, and so forth. That doesn't necessarily resonate well within African-American and Latino communities. Don't know enough about him because he hasn't addressed those issues. And frankly, Ralph Nader, really when you talk with him, and he said this publicly, these aren't my issues anyway. So you're not going to get much of a swing there in terms of blacks being influenced by Nader. But again, I have to emphasize, even if no African-Americans, no Latinos vote for Ralph Nader, with a 5-7% vote that Nader may get from progressives, liberals, anti-environmentalists, anti-corporatists, then that's significant in terms of demonstrating that Ralph Nader has pulling power, and also it could devastate the Gore campaign.
And I think the key issue, again, is not so much whether people swing for Nader, but whether they stay home.
Whether they stay home.
On election day, they get up in the morning, and they go to work, and they say, I'm not going to leave work and go to vote. And that's gonna have a big impact.
And there's a real possibility they won't. And again, you have to remember there's a great gulf between what the elected officials, I mean, they're paid to say, we're going to support Gore Lieberman. I mean, the patronage, certainly the enhancement within the party and the allegiance of the party, I mean, they're dependent on the Democrat and Republican Party. But once you get down at the grassroots level in the communities, it may be quite a different story. I can't emphasize this enough. In the last few days, I have heard so many people, especially African Americans, say, I don't like this guy Lieberman. I don't really like what I hear. And needless to say, there's one other factor that has not been mentioned at all, namely the Farrakhan factor. You know, we cannot discount that and dismiss that. He came to Los Angeles this past week, and he spoke to literally thousands and thousands of African Americans, and he made it very clear, I don't like Joe Lieberman. Now, of course, the religious thing came into it, and of course, many people said, there goes Farrakhan again, the anti-Semitism. But he also said something else. He talked about the politics of Joe Lieberman without the religious aspect of it, and many people got that message. So, again, with the Farrakhan and others out there having deep questions about Joe Lieberman and, by extension, Al Gore, Juan, we have to ask the question. Do you think they're going to rush to the barricades to vote for Gore Lieberman? I don't know.
As I said before, the discussions I've had with Latino leaders, number one, they were totally surprised about the Lieberman choice, and then there is no enthusiasm right now.
No enthusiasm whatsoever.
on the final point that we want to talk to you about, though we have a lot of issues we'd like to discuss, I just want to get a quick comment from you on police activity and the overall scandals that the LAPD has been dealing with. Yesterday, the major focus of the protests was police brutality as scores of people got arrested at the Rampart precinct, the Rampart Station House.
Well, this has been an ongoing problem in Los Angeles, as you well know. I mean, the whole history of the Los Angeles Police Department has been scandal, violence, just major, major problems with this police department. As you know, going back years and years and years, the LAPD has perhaps been probably the leading, all due respects to New York and your illustrious men and women in blue, but the LAPD has probably been the absolute symbol of police dysfunctionality in America. That hasn't changed. Yes, there have been some attempts at reform. Yes, there have been some ballot measures. Yes, now we have an inspector general in Los Angeles. But again, I knew from day one when it was announced that the Democratic National Convention would come here and also demonstrators would come here, I knew sooner or later there would be confrontation between the LAPD. I know it. I've watched it for 30 years. I know the mentality. I know the thinking. What you didn't know, Juan and Amy, before you came here, the LA Times, LA Daily News, and local press in this city, I mean, they were the LAPD, Chief Parks, and even sheriff in Los Angeles. You don't hear much about them. We do have a sheriff's department. They were baton rattling all over the place, saying, we're not going to tolerate this. We're not going to have a Seattle. We're not going to have a Washington. We're not going to have any of these things. We are going to maintain order in this city. You got to remember something else. LAPD, despite all of their bluster and baton rattling, has had a huge, huge, horrible image hit recently with the Staples Center and the violence there after the Lakers won their championship, not to mention the LA riots. So it's almost like all of these factors coming together, that the LAPD has got to show the nation, because let's face it, the nation and the world is looking at Los Angeles, that we, in fact, are in command, we're in control, we're not going to let anybody from outside take control of our streets. One other thing. It's not just, by the way, Amy and Juan, the show of force that you're seeing out there and the display of militarism on parade here. It's not just, by the way, for demonstrators, the DNC, and the media. It's also for Los Angeles, too. In other words, major, major situation in the city. Who's going to control the LAPD? The Inspector General, the Police Commission, the LA City Council, or LAPD officials personified by Chief Park? Major battle going on now over control of the LAPD, and also major battling over funding sources for the LAPD. By that I mean increasing funding for certain programs. So again, all of these things are up in the air, and so there's high stakes involved here beyond just the DNC and the demonstrators.
And, well, we had the surprise of the mayor of Philadelphia, John Street, saying that the LA police were acting like stormtroopers when he was his police were picking people up on $100,000 bail, $1 million bail for misdemeanors.
And yeah. I was watching them beat the protesters.
I was going to say, not to mention, I mean, a week before that, I mean, beating the bejesus out of somebody in the streets, a so-called carjacker, I mean, on world TV.
With the picture of that beating going out on T-shirts being sold by a policeman. Inside a police precinct. Well, I want to thank you very much, Earl Afari Hutchinson, for joining us again. His latest book is called The Disappearance of Black Leadership. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And having us in your hometown.
Welcome to L.A.
Well, folks, we are going to move into the issue of police brutality and strategies of resistance. Today, Juan and I went over to the Rampart Station, where there was a major protest. More than 1,000 people turned out to protest police brutality and corruption. About 30 people were arrested. Then the group moved on. There were thousands who went on to demonstrate in front of police headquarters and then on to try to get to the Staples Center protest pen, and they were charged by police. But at the Rampart Station, I did have a chance to talk with police officers about what's been happening over the week, particularly Monday night, when they fired rubber bullets, pepper spray, tear gas at people who had gone to a concert and a political rally at the Staples Center. And also got a chance to ask Carol Sobel, who we had on yesterday, who is a national an ACLU, former ACLU lawyer. She was a legal observer at these demonstrations. Ask her the response. She's one of those who got hit with a rubber bullet during Monday night's actions. Excuse me, could you tell me what the cylinders are, the silver cylinders?
You're talking press relations, ma'am. She's not allowed to talk.
But what are the cylinders?
Pardon me?
The cylinders.
Some kind of munition for this.
And what do they do?
I can't explain. I don't really know.
Silver canisters we saw some of the officers wearing. What are they?
Those are part of our less lethal munitions. And their purpose is to provide that should we have to take some type of defensive posture and within a crowd control or an aggressor type situation, that it affords us the ability to use an alternative other than batons and or tear gas.
It. You don't have any justification for shooting at people, lethal or non-lethal, when they're walking out and doing what you told them to do. You had almost 10,000 people who had to disperse. You put up barriers so it would slow them down, and they started firing within about 20 minutes of the first announcement.
The crowd had ample opportunity to leave.
10, 15 minutes? Thousands of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you seen a big hall that can? You ever been to a football game? Those things are gone in 20 minutes.
They didn't get plenty of time to leave, and they had barriers that were put in place on Monday morning that were not there on Sunday from the Mumia demonstration. We had just gone to Commander Brennan and asked him to make a second announcement. He made the announcement. He said, "We will give you all reasonably sufficient time." Within a minute of that, they fired. They opened fire.
Did you see the deluge of rocks and steel pipes and other devices that were thrown over that fence?
There were not hundreds of people who were throwing things, but if they had dispersed in the crowd and were no longer throwing things, why would you shoot the people who were leaving?
When people have an opportunity to leave and they don't, and we use some devices that cause people to get their attention, we're bad guys. Well.
Amazing way to get the crowd's attention. They got the attention of the people who were leaving the parking lot. Bola and I got hit with a rubber bullet in my forehead, and I have an ever increasing set of black eyes.
That was Carol Sobel and Officer Pasquarello, who was at the Rampart Station yesterday as the demonstrators were leaving. Carol Sobel, a lawyer who was hit herself and continued to be out on the streets yesterday protesting police brutality. And in the next half of our show today, we're going to talk about strategies of resistance. Beginning with the major demonstrations in Seattle, a group of masked young men and women dressed in black have taken part in anti-globalization and police brutality protests that have taken place in Seattle, Philadelphia, and now in Los Angeles. They've been called the Black Bloc by the media, and they've claimed responsibility for smashing corporate property, such as the windows of multinational corporations like McDonald's and Starbucks. By the way, the McDonald's was boarded up right near the Independent Media Center where we are. It is open for business, but there are no windows that are exposed. When I went inside, I asked the manager, why the boards? And she said, well, the Democratic Convention is here. I said, are you concerned about the delegates? Yeah, I know President Clinton loves McDonald's, but she said, no, it is the protesters. Well, the actions of the Black Bloc have been condemned widely by the police, the media, and even in the activist community. People have said that they are disruptive and provocative. Many of them claim to be anarchists, but there are other activists who say they've misinterpreted the ideals of non-hierarchical consensus-building organizing. Today, we're going to have a discussion with a number of activists who are involved with different campaigns but have come together at these different places, from Los Angeles to Seattle to Washington to Philadelphia, to make their views known. We're going to start with Tim Ream, who's with Pickaxe Productions. In fact, I called you by calling 1-888-PICKAXE.
Ooh, thank you for the ad.
Well, tell us about your philosophy. You were in Seattle.
I was in Seattle. I wore a mask for a time that I was on the street in Seattle. And I openly advocate for property destruction, strategic property destruction, as a tactic. I think the first black bloc in North America that I'm aware of was, they went by the name of Sons of Liberty. And in 1773, they painted their faces up black. They went out into the dark of night, and they destroyed a great deal of corporate property. Today, we refer to them as the Boston Tea Party, and they were the spark of revolution in this country. And I think that in the minds of a lot of people who are involved in the black bloc, we're looking for the next spark because things are about to go over the edge.
I want to ask you how you came up with the name Black Bloc, but that's after the break. We are going to break for 60 seconds for stations to identify themselves. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcasting from the Independent Media Center at Patriotic Hall in Los Angeles. Stay with us.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood and the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before. How governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fan the flame. To those wars that are fought in places we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these ones we call our friend? These governments killing their own. Or is it the ones who can't take anymore, so they pick up a brick or a gun or a stone? They're alive in the balance.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we broadcast from Los Angeles during this Democratic National Convention, when there are a lot of activities inside the convention hall at the Staples, yes, named for a large corporation convention center in downtown Los Angeles, Joseph Lieberman having just spoken last night, but also outside the convention center. When I tried to get into the convention last night, well, it took me a number of hours as I got caught up in watching what was going on outside with thousands of police officers confronting thousands of demonstrators being, to say the least, extremely aggressive. And now we're talking about strategies of resistance with a group of activists, from Tim Ream of Pickaxe Productions to Kevin Danaher, co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange and editor of the book Downsize This. Alicia Littletree is from Northern California Earth First and a paralegal in the Judy Barry case. And Rachel Jackson is with us, a Bay Area activist who organizes around issues of police brutality and women. Juan?
Yes, well, I'd like to follow up with Tim Ream, and then we're going to ask some of the other people to join in also. In terms of this, I went to cover the Ramparts demonstration yesterday, and I noticed the first thing that the organizers did is they asked, before they set off on the march, they asked everyone to raise their hands if they were committed not to get involved in any kind of violence during the march, and in fact urged anyone who did not want to make that commitment not to join. So there's obviously a debate going on within the protesters and the movement here. I'm sure a lot of listeners and a lot of people who are viewing this are saying, what do you hope to gain by this property destruction? And are you not concerned that the actions that some of the people who espouse your views take bring down then police repression on other people who don't necessarily agree? Because some of the actions that I've seen are occurring from within large crowds of people.
Well, I don't think that what happened at Rampart today is in any way a sign alone of debate within the movement, although it's certainly there. The organizers of the March to Rampart, certainly one of the most evil houses of police officers locally, or local police officers anywhere in the country, included organizing in some rather unique communities, three-strike candidates, parolees, undocumented people. And that being the case, there were people in the crowd that if there was any sort of arrest that was not a planned and well-orchestrated arrest, would have endured a far, far greater penalty than people who are otherwise privileged to not be in that position. So, you know, that was called for in this particular march, and it was honored in this particular march. And, you know, it's good to see that there is an opportunity for different types of tactics to be employed in different situations. Now, the whole question is going to be around effectiveness of Black Bloc, but we're also going to have to ask about the question of effectiveness of other tactics. I mean, I don't feel like in 30 years of the environmental movement that environmental issues have moved forward. You know, we've got something like a Clean Air Act and a Clean Water Act, and yet we have species dying off at the greatest rate since mammals walked the earth. We have an ozone layer that seems to surprise people with its size, and we have global climate change, which could really pretty much change everything. And that being the case, we have to ask ourselves, you know, how effective have we been with other forms of tactics? My guess is if you pick up the LA Times tomorrow, you're going to see that the police acted with amazing restraint and a great professional demeanor outside of Rampart, and it will call into question everything else that you've heard about the Rampart Division. So is that an effective protest? I wonder.
Well, what about that question? Rachel, what's your response to how effective other tactics have been in dealing with some of the issues that you came here for?
Well, I want to address particularly this question of property damage as a strategy. To me, property damage is something that occurs. It is a kind of political expression that occurs. It occurs in different types of protests, and it occurs, people do it for different reasons. People do it in different settings. The kinds of things that people destroy are not, it's not simply things like Starbucks. I mean, there have been very, very important things that people have destroyed, like nuclear warheads, railroad tracks that transport nuclear warheads. You know, on women's marches, people destroy pornographic news racks, which is a whole other issue which we're not going to get into, but, you know, Operation Rescue, picket signs. There are many, many forms of destruction of things. And I think it's important that we not, number one, in terms of mobilization and mass mobilization, I think it is a mistake to create, to make property damage into a kind of a loyalty oath where the good protesters are separated from bad protesters on the basis of whether or not they will promise or swear not to destroy property. Property gets destroyed in the moment. Property sometimes is destroyed, and people have very good reasons for hating the things that they're destroying. People burn the American flag all over the world, and when people burn the American flag, that is an act of political resistance. It's an act of hatred, and it's an expression because of what the United States has done to people all over the world and historically. When people trash police cars, those police cars have carried us and our sisters and our brothers and our parents alive and dead into the prisons, into the jails, and those things are symbols, and they are practical tools of repression against us. And when people see them and destroy them, I don't think that should be a reason to say, well, that type of expression is not legitimate. People have legitimate reasons to hate the state, the symbols of the state, and the symbols of repression in this country.
Kevin Danaher, Global Exchange.
I want to try and ask a strategic question and have the tactical stuff come underneath that. For me, the key question is, how do we build a mass movement? How do we build a revolutionary movement? I've traveled a lot around the world and seen a lot of suffering and injustice. And what motivates me every day when I get out of bed is figuring out how I can possibly play a role in building a revolutionary movement in the United States that will change this system that is oppressing so many people in so many different parts of the world. And I think the way you build a mass movement is you recruit new sectors and you try and solidify and strengthen the existing segments of the coalition. And what I see when I go out talking to mainstream audiences, people are freaked out when they see conflict between cops and demonstrators. And it sort of bags all of us then as a bunch of people who were, you know, don't really have issues. We don't have an analysis. We just like to throw things. If you look at the Seattle significance, the WTO protest, the WTO didn't shut down because some people broke some windows. They shut down because we prevented them from having their meeting. And that was largely done by people putting their bodies out on the street and locking arms and not letting delegates get in there. So our unity on the outside created disunity inside the WTO, and they didn't get to launch what was going to be a several year process of negotiating new rules for the global economy, which would have screwed workers and it would have screwed the environment. So there's also the additional question, and I'm not against property destruction. I accept all these points that are made about property destruction. It's the process by which the decision is made to destroy property. If a group reaches consensus and all of those people in that group are willing to take the consequences, I have no problem, you know, people banging on warheads, the Boston Tea Party, all those examples are valid examples. It's a question of developing a democratic process of deciding how you're going to do it. I don't think anybody has the right to endanger the physical safety of other people. And you don't need to be a brain surgeon to know that if I'm in the front line throwing rocks at the cops and they start shooting and I duck or run, some innocent people are going to get shot.
Kevin, it's going to be a long question. There's a couple of different points here. First of all, you want to build a mass movement or you want to build a revolutionary mass movement? And if you want to build a revolutionary mass movement...
I use both adjectives.
Right. If you want to build a revolutionary mass movement, then you're going to have to take revolutionary action and not reformist action while you're engaged in it. So that's that'd be the first point. Secondly, have you looked at the tape of who shut out the delegates? When it came to push come to shove in front of the Sheraton Hotel, there were quite a lot of people there who probably were also people who were later on in the day engaging in property destruction after the WTO had been shut down.
Yeah, well, let's not get this into where I'm defending the police. I'm going to be the first
one to criticize the stuff they did. What I'm saying. I'm saying that, like, let's... It almost sounds like, you know, what I've heard over and over again, and this sounds like a reinforcement of it, is that there were two kinds of direct action protesters. There were the ones who broke things, and there were the ones who shut out the delegates, and those were two different sets of people. And I've seen a lot of video footage. I'm a video producer, and I've been involved in two productions that about the WTO. And I've seen a whole lot of video footage, and I can tell you that a lot of people that were blocking out those delegates were wearing masks. They had the big circle A all over emblazoned on their signs, and their
A for anarchists.
Yeah, for the.
But
for
you would agree that none of us have the right as individuals to jeopardize the physical safety of others.
I would definitely agree that it is the case that we should, as much as possible, try to come to a consensus process when we're developing these tactics. I would hope that you would agree that we're living in a world that, as two white middle class men, we're living in a huge amount of privilege here in the United States of America, and
right.
that it's not just a matter of maintaining our own and our fellow protesters' safety. It's also a matter of maintaining the safety of, for instance, the Zapatistas who have taken up arms in Chiapas, of maintaining the safety of Iraqi children who are being deprived of food and medicine.
Right.
So if I throw a rock and because of it somehow the police come down a little harder on you, but I throw my rock and I actually believe strategically that it's going to try to save an Iraqi child's life or it's going to bring down more heat on the Mexican government that's fighting against the people of Chiapas, then, you know, it might be the case that we're going to have to give up a little of our privilege and a little of our safety and push a few boundaries to protect others and to protect the earth.
Alicia Littletree from the Northern California Earth First, can you tell us your perspective when he's throwing the rock, what the impact is on you and how you feel about it?
Yeah, well, the thing about this debate that always bothers me is when property destruction is somehow described as if it's the most radical tactic and you use rhetoric about Iraqi children and, you know, starving people who aren't so privileged. What happens when one person decides to take individual action and throw a rock in a situation where we are trying to build a movement based on collective mass action? What we've seen over and over again in our community, I've been involved in our struggle has been about 15 years long, nonviolent direct action struggle in a rural community in Northern California, is that the way violence is used against us is twofold. There's a false association of nonviolent activists with violence that is used to discredit us and used to isolate us in our communities. And this has an effect of whipping up fear and hatred against us. We've seen this over and over again in Seattle and in even here in Los Angeles, justifying the extreme measures that police take against us. And secondarily, in our communities, you talk about privilege. Well, in our communities, we are essentially, in a lot of ways, in the rural community in Northern California, Earth Firsters have become a minority in a certain way. Earth Firsters, I have driven by an effigy of a hanged Earth Firster in Northern California. One of the things that is told to people who work in the logging industry, which is where our struggle is based, is that we are violent, that we are terrorists, and that we want to take away people's jobs. And so, in fact, what happens is it divides our communities, that violence is actually whipped up against us, and it can have some very extreme and tragic consequences against our organizers. That's another thing. You might wear a black mask over your face, but there are a lot of very outspoken, very courageous spokespeople in this movement who, when grand juries come down, are the first people to get a knock on their door from the FBI or from, you know, from the federal government. We become the targets of violence. This is the double standard in this, is that while they're falsely associating us with violence, we become, the violence is actually being done to us and to the visible spokespeople, the people taking principled, very confrontational nonviolent direct action in our communities. And I have a lot more respect for people who are willing to get out on the front lines, put their bodies on the line, show their faces, speak their minds, stand with their neighbors and their fellow people in the movement, and take this action than I do from people who have to hide their face and run away.
Well, Alicia, as you know, I'm sitting here without a mask, and my name and my 888 phone number are out over the air. As you also know, in 1996, I sat there in a redwood tree in Northern California and had a gun pointed at me. I've had a logger jump me when I was holding the video camera doing unmasked actions. And when the grand jury comes knocking, I wouldn't be surprised to find it happening at my door, too.
But what if the grand jury comes knocking, Tim, for something that you don't endorse, you don't believe in, when it happens to us, like, for instance, in our community, Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney were the targets of a car bomb assassination attempt. What happened within 3 hours of the bomb exploding?
But of course, that didn't have anything to do with people doing property destruction ahead of time. That was because Daryl and Judy were such fantastic organizers and had put together such an incredible plan for protecting the Redwoods that the repression of the state began to come down on their heads.
In fact, Judy and Daryl had renounced property destruction.
Yeah, I know.
And that made them even more powerful and more effective because they were able to build alliances with working people in our communities, with poor people, with women, with people of color. You know, this kind of stuff stands in the way of us building strong alliances with people who might not be as privileged as we are.
I'd like to propose a test. We could do a test. September 26th, S26, is Global Day of Action Against Corporate Rule. There's going to be a lot of people up on Capitol Hill trying to affect legislation on corporate power. There might even be some people out protesting on K Street in Washington. And people are calling, this is when the big Prague demonstrations are going to happen at the IMF World Bank meetings in Prague. We could have a separation of turf. And people who believe in property destruction could go to the World Bank IMF headquarters in Washington. People who believe in nonviolence could stay away from those buildings. And people who believe in property destruction could focus on those buildings or some other target. The problem is when you're in a large group and you form a small minority of that group and you do a provocative act that brings down repression, if I'm in between you and the police, that's not fair. That's not right.
On that note, we have to wrap up this discussion. I want to thank you all for being with us. Alicia Littletree from Northern California Earth First, Rachel Jackson, activist from the Bay Area, Kevin Danaher, co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange, and Tim Rehm of Pickaxe Productions. And that does it for this segment of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Broadcasting live from the Independent Media Center in downtown Los Angeles, a very important discussion that is happening within the activist community dealing with the issue of property destruction. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill with help from Deepa Fernandez. Our technical director is Grayson Challenger. We had assistance from Karen Palmer and Nell Geiser. Sanazma Zafarian. Video production is by Dee Dee Halleck, Skip Blumberg, Linda Ayanna Cohn, John Hamilton, Ben Thomas, Peter St. Marie, Carlos Perea, Jonathan Stewart, and Chase Pearson. Also, internet production by Prothop Chatterjee. He is our new media reporter on our website, www.democracynow.org. Thanks to Paper Tiger Television, Deep Dish TV, and the Independent Media Center in Los Angeles. From the IMC, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from the Independent Media Center in Los Angeles. Breaking with convention, power, protest, and the presidency, police violence towards protesters continues in the streets of L.A. and will continue with an ongoing discussion around strategies of resistance. What about property destruction? Also, a wetlands ecosystem in Los Angeles is threatened by the largest private developer in the country. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
And in the news, embarking on what he called a miraculous journey, Vice Presidential candidate Joseph Lieberman urged Americans Wednesday night to elect Al Gore to the White House, hailing him before the Democratic National Convention as a man of, quote, vision and values, end of quote, who would extend the nation's current prosperity.
And protesters outside the Democratic National Convention converged at the Staples Center, thousands of them, as they demanded an end to police brutality. Yesterday, at the beginning of the day, their march went to the Rampart Division, the Rampart Station, where there are scores of police officers who've been charged with police brutality and corruption. At the protest outside the Staples Center, police charged the protesters, knocking many of them down.
And this news from Moscow. The Russian Orthodox Church's highest body on Wednesday closed a meeting highlighted by the decision to canonize Tsar Nicholas II. The Bishop's Council also adopted a social doctrine that denounces the use of force in international affairs and that calls for the end of the death penalty, according to Russian reports. The Church opposes the death penalty not only because it can make a judicial error irreparable, but also because the penalty causes controversy in society, according to the Taras news agency.
Last night, when Joseph Lieberman addressed the convention floor, he spoke about a number of issues that have raised concern in the African-American and Latino community, particularly among, those on the floor, the Congressional Black Caucus. This is an excerpt of his address.
And I've also tried to see America through the eyes of people I've been privileged to know. In the early 1960s, when I was a college student, I walked with Martin Luther King in the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. That was my honor. That was my opportunity. And later that fall, I went to Mississippi, where we worked to register African Americans to vote. The people I met never forgot that in America, every time a barrier is broken, the doors of open opportunity go wider for every single one of us. And I know that in a very personal way tonight. And I've tried to see America through the eyes of families who had the deck stacked against them but fought back. As Connecticut's Attorney General, I work to be the people's lawyer. I went after polluters who were spoiling our water and our air. I stood with single moms to go after deadbeat dads. And you know what? We even sued oil companies who were trying to gouge consumers at the pump. Yes, we did.
you.
We're going to go right to the White House for a better America.
Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman accepting the Democratic nomination for vice presidential candidate of the Democratic Party last night in Los Angeles. Tonight, it is Al Gore's turn to accept the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
This year, let's give the folks at home something to cheer about.
The future just keeps coming at you.
And from where we stand tonight, we can now see the shimmering rays of light that signal the dawn of the 21st century.
Hail Starfleet Command.
No response on standard frequencies. Curious. I am picking up a multitude of narrowband EM signals.
Let's hear.
I do not believe we can maintain 400,000 troops there, much beyond the spring of next year, and that therefore our general position will be improved. Yes, we will be driven to that decision.
All of this has happened before, and it will all happen again.
I do not believe, Mr. Chairman, that time is on our side.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution please raise their hands?
Better time to be alive than now. There couldn't be a better country in which to be born and in which to live than now, because you hold the future.
The fighting broke out overnight in a brutal replay of earlier clashes pitted rival organizations against one another.